Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Every August, fanatical antiques collectors and experts alike gather in New Orleans for the Historic New Orleans Collections Antiques Forum. This year's forum centered on the dining room and all the magical pieces that have made that room so special throughout history. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're taking you to the Antiques Forum with Nick Dawes, an antiques appraiser who you may already know from Antiques Roadshow. Then, we visit with John Stewart Gordon, curator of American Decorative Arts at the Yale University Art Gallery. Finally, we tour the former estate of Henry Francis DuPont, which now houses Winter Tour Museum, with curator Tom Savage. We're going treasure hunting while never leaving the dining room on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Those of us who are in the antiques business, you can't invite us into your home without expecting us to turn the plates over, look at the marks on the silver, pull the drawers out of the furniture, and all that.
For Nick Dawes, every antique tells a story. As an appraiser for the long-running PBS program, Antiques Roadshow, Nick's expertise gives him a remarkable view into the lives of people and their ancestors through the relics they bring to the show. Nick is also Vice President of Special Collections at the prestigious Heritage Auction Galleries in New York. We had the great fortune to spend some time with Nick when he was a guest speaker at the annual Historic New Orleans Collections Antiques Forum, where he's an annual participant because of his vast knowledge of ceramics and glass. To begin our conversation with Nick, I asked him about Antiques Roadshow and his involvement with the program.
Antiques Roadshow, when it began, visited more cities than it does today. In the first season, I believe we visited 12 or 13 cities, making one show from each city. Today, we typically go to six cities through the summer, and from each city, we'll make 3 hours of television, with one or two more hours made from what's left over. We'll go to a city, usually arriving on Thursday or Friday, have meetings through the day, and then it all happens on Saturday. Everything's taped in one day. I sit typically at the pottery and porcelain table, which is a very highly trafficked table. Everyone has a piece of pottery or porcelain, and increasingly we find that people are bringing things in, not exclusively to find out what it's worth, the monetary value. First of all, at pottery and porcelain table, we see very few things of high value. All those big numbers you see on Antiques Roadshow tend to be sometimes Chinese things or paintings, you know. We're the poor relation. The typical value at my table is under $20. Most things are under $20. But most people want to know what it is and where it's from. It very often, if it's something at my table, will be perhaps the oldest thing in the family, you know? And they'll want to know, did this come from Ireland with Great Aunt Mary in 1860 or not? And we'll be able to look at it and identify its origin and its age and everything else, and perhaps to either confirm or not confirm a family story. There are literally thousands of experiences I could tell you about, and so many of them are memorable to both of us, that being to the guest who comes and to the appraiser. But I recall a story from, I think it was at least 10 years ago, we were in Savannah, Georgia. And toward the end of the afternoon, these two spectacular African-American ladies came up to the table. And they were dressed up for the event. They looked like they were going to church. You know, they had everything, including hats on. They're really taking it seriously. And I said what I always say, which is, let's see, you know, what have you got? And tell me what you'd like to know about it. And the lady took out a little porcelain figure, 6 inches high, and this little figure was this exquisitely modeled 1960s Tupperware lady with a sort of A-line skirt, beehive hairdo, not looking anything like the woman who brought it in. And she was holding in her hand proudly a stack of graduated Tupperware. And I said, all right, well, tell me about the figure. And she said, well, I was a Tupperware lady in the late 60s, and I sold enough Tupperware, and they gave me this. And I fell in love with the figure for lots of reasons. First of all, my mother was a Tupperware lady in the late 60s in England, and I remember fondly running back and forth from the kitchen to the living room with stacks of Tupperware that she was trying to sell. So I identified with that. But most importantly, from a historical point of view, we see lots of porcelain figures, and the majority of them are renderings of 18th century characters made at any point after the 18th century. They're these sort of historical figures made in Germany mostly, or Japan, in porcelain, trying to look more important than they are. And it's quite rare to find what we call a period figure, something that represents the year in which it was made. And this is a critical ingredient in good, authentic objects. So here's an entirely authentic, quite beautifully and an exquisitely made porcelain figure from the late 60s, which frankly has modest value monetarily at the moment. But I told her that it's one of the best things I'd seen all day in terms of its quality and authenticity. And it represented a kind of narrow but unique window in American history in terms of what Tupperware was doing and how it was being marketed. Quite an important window in the history of commercialism. So I loved the object, and I was able to give her a modest value, but I told her that if she held on to it and brought it back in about 150 years, it would undoubtedly be valuable. But to me, that was a museum quality object, something that belonged as part of the American story.
One of your expertise also falls into the category of crystal, and Lalique is a big passion of yours in particular.
It is, and I discovered the work of René Lalique, who was the founder of the Lalique Company, really when I moved to New York in 1979. I had seen some of it earlier. I had bought a little piece of Lalique when I was a teenager, but it was really not until I worked in the auction business that I discovered Lalique and fell in love with it and wrote a book on it 30 years ago. He was an extraordinary individual, a genius in design and manufacturing technique. The leading jeweler in the world by the time he was 40 years old in 1900, and could quite happily, I suspect, have continued in that position and that sort of elegant Parisian life, but chose to do something quite different, moved into glass making. So all of that legacy of glass that he's left us is very much a second career. And the work of Lalique turns up occasionally at auctions and throughout the world of antiques. It's always fascinating to me. And I've built much of my career around Lalique.
Is there some holy grail of a piece that you know exists, but that you've never been able to see?
Well, yes. Certainly I've seen photographs and renderings of objects. Some jewelry, but particularly objects that he made at the time, 1900 to about 1910, when he was in transition between his career as a jeweler, and that as a glassmaker. And these transitional objects, some of which are just extraordinary tour de force of craftsmanship and design, there are far fewer of them that we know exist than those that were manufactured. Now, we have to account for many of them being destroyed over time. Europe's been through two world wars, but we like to think that some of those things are still there. They tend to be made of a combination of materials, glass, metal, perhaps horn, ivory, things like this, enamels, all put together in a manner that can be best described as Renaissance, but is commonly thought of as just the Lalique style, the steel Lalique. So yes, a few of those I'd love to find.
I don't know if people realize that his work wasn't limited. Yes, there was the beautiful jewelry and the decorative objects, and then, of course, you know, glassware and such. But how astounding is it when you come across an entire window panel like the ones they have in Henri Bendel's in New York? What are some of those larger, more spectacular things that you've come across?
I'm very glad that you understand that depth of Lalique. Architectural glass became quite an important part of Lalique's commercial empire later on, certainly by the 1930s. But it's evidence of his extraordinary ability that he could design everything in glass from a tiny piece of jewelry to an entire building facade. The best one in New York is the one you reference, and the best one in the United States, really, is the one you reference. There are a couple more. In Europe, I like to point people toward René Lalique's own house in Paris with spectacular glass doors, which were installed in 1903, before he even had his own glassworks or any real history of manufacturing glass. They're still there. They're just as beautiful as ever.
Thanks so much. I hope we have a chance to speak again sometime on Louisiana Eats. And in the meantime, we'll keep an eye out for you on Antiques Roadshow. We'll be looking for you there. Thank you.
Thank you. Monday nights at 8.
That was Nick Dawes, author and appraiser for Antiques Roadshow. When we return from a short break, we'll explore one of my personal antique obsessions, sterling silver flatware, with John Stewart Gordon, curator of decorative arts at the Yale University Museum. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Brennan's Restaurant. Breakfast at Brennan's, featuring Chef Slade Rushing's updated classic Creole cuisine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and private events at 417 Royal Street in the historic French Quarter. A fascination with antiques often leads to obsession. John Stewart Gordon is a prime example of how this fascination can also lead to some of the most compelling treasure hunts. John has the unique honor of curating American decorative arts at the Yale University Art Gallery, creating for himself the perfect marriage of passion and career. During the Historic New Orleans Collection's annual Antiques Symposium, I discovered that John and I share a mutual obsession with antique silver flatware, an investment in beautiful design that can be used every single day.
Everybody knows flatware. We use it every day. We have a personal relationship with it. Of all of the objects in the world, it probably comes into the closest physical contact with us. And it's a kind of exciting to think about, where did these forms come from and how did this ritual of dining emerge in the mid-19th century? Because we have such close connections with these objects. And even though they were popular more than a century ago, we still feel quite passionate about them.
Where did your fascination with this begin?
It began by not understanding what these strange things I saw were. Funny implements with prongs sticking out the sides, things with that had handles that clamped down. And being a child of the 20th century, we didn't have things like asparagus tongs and macaroni forks when I grew up. And so I just started kind of exploring what on earth these things are. And this story unfolded that was really wonderful and complicated. They are little microcosms of all of the goals and aspirations of the 19th century. They're not just for serving food. They're a reflection of where America was and where America wanted to be. And once I drew that connection, I just fell down the rabbit hole, because it's easy to do. There are hundreds of different flatware forms, things that boggle your mind, jelly servers, gravy spoons, dish gravy spoons, which is different than a normal gravy spoon.
A dish gravy spoon?
A dish gravy spoon.
What is that?
I haven't a clue.
So, you haven't seen one?
No, and if one of your listeners knows of one, you know, reach out to me, because going through old catalogs from silver companies, you see lists and lists and lists. One company had over 69 different serving forms listed, 23 different kinds of spoons, 8 different kinds of tongs, 16 different kinds of knife. And if you go into an antique store now or on eBay or even to a museum, we'll just say knife. But there were 16 options. And we've lost that part of dining culture, because for us, a knife is a knife.
Tell us about the collection at Yale. How long have you been in charge of the collection? And what are the sort of things that were there before and that now you are steering the collection towards?
I've been at the Yale University Art Gallery for 10 years now. And I'm so lucky, because it's an extraordinary collection. The American Decorative Arts Collection was, for the most part, dates to about 1930. It was collected by one Yale alum named Francis P. Garvin. His passion was 17th and 18th century Americana. And we have one of the finest early American silver collections in the world. In the 1970s, one of my predecessors, Charles Montgomery, who had been at Winterthur, came up to the Yale University Art Gallery to take over the curatorship. And he realized the collection should not stop in the 19th century, but should go right up to the present and be kind of a document of American craftsmanship from the beginning of colonial settlement up to the present day. So since the 1970s, we have been building the collection forward in time. The part I'm most proud of is building our 20th century collection, with strong holdings in the 1930s and kind of the Art Deco period. And we recently acquired the Swid Powell Collection and Archives, and that was a venture of the 1980s that invited architects to design housewares. So plates and flatware designed by Zaha Hadid, Robert A.M. Stern, Michael Graves, and that kind of brings us all the way up to the present day.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the rarer marks. What have you come across that you've seen marked on a piece of silver and had to go figure out what that is and where it came from?
We're very lucky at Yale. We were given a collection about 20 years ago, long before I got there, of about a couple thousand pieces of flatware, which was a not encyclopedic, but very complete record of almost every 19th century silver mark. I have a lot committed to memory, but luckily I also have our storage where we can go and look up things. So if we find a mark we don't recognize, we go to the silver vault and pull out the spoons and forks until we can find it. And every once in a while we get stumped. There was a nut service that had come up for auction earlier this year, and I fell in love with it because there were little nut picks and a big serving spoon decorated with squirrels, with like an adorable little squirrel perched over the bowl of the spoon, kind of peering into the spoon at the nuts that it would want to eat. So imaginative. And it had a CW mark that the auction house could not identify. And I started poking around, and no one could identify it. But it also had a patent date. So one morning, when I guess I woke up feeling a bit more focused than I do normally, I sat down and started going through every single patent that was issued that year. And after a few hours of just kind of going through patents, I found the drawing by a man named Augustus Conrad in Philadelphia for this squirrel-decorated spoon. And that led me down a different rabbit hole of going into the ancestry records, trying to figure out who this man was. And sure enough, he's listed in Philadelphia as a silversmith. And then for 2 years, he's listed in partnership with someone whose last name was W. And suddenly that CW that no one could figure out, that was this very short-lived partnership. So it's fun that even with a great resource like Yale's collection, there's still a lot of marks out there that we don't know. But if you just roll up your shirt sleeves and dig into the archives, you can kind of find them.
You have anything else up your sleeve, John?
Oh, a number of them. But the one thing was struck by, and it was a realization I had very late in the game, I think like last week. I was looking at the slides, and oysters are a big thing in the 19th century. And there's so many wonderful oyster services, oyster forks, oyster spoons, oyster ladles. So I was diving into the oyster, and then that brought me to the lobster. And it was only by happenstance that I noticed that the few pieces of lobster-related material I'm showing all have New Orleans histories.
Really?
They're either retailed here or owned here. And so if the Northeast kind of is the home of the lobster, you know, there's definitely a long history for them here in Louisiana as well with crawfish. And it's so interesting that there are certain foods that have this regional specificity. And if you look at the silver, it goes along with it as well.
Are there any other holy grails that you're seeking?
Always.
I think that's a really, if we're talking about silver, the Holy Grail really suits that image. So,
Oh yeah, unless you really believe the Indiana Jones movies, and then we're talking about a piece of wood.
Right. Yeah, so.
A curator's life is making Holy Grails, or finding Holy Grails. For this period, the one pattern we don't have at the Art Gallery's collection is Gorham's Narragansett, and I've been in love with it for years, and I've fallen in love with it again doing the research for this talk. Just so inventive. Every piece was different. How you encrust the forms with little cast pieces of seaweed and cast crabs and cast shells. And the whimsy of it is just so wonderful. And I think it's a very powerful statement of the late 19th century interest in naturalism. Kind of reflects the aesthetic period, reflects Japanism, and ultimately, though, it's located in the American landscape with that name, Narragansett, for the Narragansett Indians, the Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, where Gorham was headquartered. So it's both kind of eternal and specific at the same time. So that's what I'm thinking about these days. If I can.
I imagine there must not be very much of it.
There's not much of it, and unfortunately other people know how lovely it is too. So there's not much of it, and it's expensive. But it is wonderful. So every time I see a piece at an antique store or an auction, I just go and hold it for a little while, and that'll keep me for now.
John Stewart Gordon, curator of American Decorative Arts at the Yale University Art Gallery. Je sais juste qui vous êtes. Des feux tournent dans ma tête. Et les portes s'ouvrent de battant. Je vous attends. For Christophe Pourny, preserving antique furniture is much more than a craft. It's a calling. Learning antique restoration from a young age in his father's antique shop in the south of France, Christophe has become a revered furniture historian and conservator over the past 20 years.
So I am Christophe Pourny, and I am an antique restorer, antique conservation. I've always done that. So when people ask me, where did you learn? Where I didn't learn. I was born in an antique store in France. My parents were antique dealers. So it's in my gene. It's a passion. I try to get rid of it. I tried to get rid of it, you know, to shake it off. But I can't. It's impossible. It always catches me back, you know. So
you just can't get away from that pull of the antique furniture.
Antiques is really a passion. I mean, old stuff. It's really unbelievable what you can find and what you can deal with.
Each piece really sort of tells its own story, doesn't it?
Because it's unique. Everything is unique. And I think it's very important nowadays where everything is standard, normalized, everything is bought from big chains of furniture or as good as they are, you know. But everybody should have one piece that is unique, that you have at home and where you can look at it when you come back at night from work and you're tired and tell you, I'm the only one right now that has this piece of furniture in the world.
Well, I'd like to focus on the dining room. What is your favorite style of table for dining?
The favorite style of dining table is and has to be a 19th century table. Why? Because this is about the 1850s that really the dining room and the dining experience we know nowadays really, really started to exist. Before, it was a little bit all over the place. People had small table on the sides. People had rooms that were not dining rooms, the hall, the side rooms or whatever. The parlor initially was a dining room, used as a dining room. That's where it started. Parlor is from the French, parler, to speak. And when the kings and when the royalty, you know, starting not to want to have dinners in this big banquet hall, you know, in front of everybody, they retired to a small room on the side because they could parler, they could speak a little more privately, and that become the parlor eventually.
Yeah. I didn't know that. That's a wonderful thing to know.
And then again, once the parlor, dining, living existed, the two rooms separated. They said, like, okay, wait, we can do even better. One that is going to become the living room, the parlor, and one that is going to be just for dining. So the servants can set it up, clean it up, and we don't have to entertain ourselves, you know, and our guests around the table for the entire duration of the evening. 19th century, a room is starting to be designed as a formal dining room, used only for that. And the style of furniture, of course, the table and the chairs, are going to be designed specially for dining. So a good Victorian, I know there's always a bad rap about Victorian furniture, but a good Victorian dining table is the best thing you can have as a dining table. It's sturdy, it gets bigger with nice leaves, it has a mechanism that still can work, it has the right height, it's the right proportions. If you want a dinner, you better have a 19th century table, or even later, but they are going to be copied on the same concept.
Would you give us a little walk through the history of chair design?
Yes. People have always needed to sit somewhere. Weirdly enough, people need to sleep and to eat, but beds have not always existed, and dining tables neither. But there have always been seats. And they started from the most simple structures of planks joined with rustic nails or rustic kind of knots, you know, to some very, very elaborate forms and shape and design. As time evolved and times got more refined and more peaceful and richer, so through the evolution of the chair, you really have almost the evolution of humanity and history for the past 2,000 years, from medieval times where everything got very rough at the fall of the Roman Empire, through medieval times, through Renaissance, classical age, 18th century, 19th century. And you really historically tell, oh, this is why this style was at this precise time because of. And the chair follows, you know, like the shape and the historic events almost years by years. If I say that fashion moves in parallel of history or social movements, I don't think it's going to shock anybody. People would be pretty, yes, okay, I can understand that. And we see that. But if I say what I just said about furniture, people are going to be more like, how is the leg of furniture has to do with history? So if you put the two together, you can see that, oh yeah, actually it does. So for example, if we take three kings that followed each other, Louis XIV, Louis XV, Louis XVI, the one that got his head cut. So it started with Louis XIV, which is a very powerful, absolute, regal monarch that liked things, of course, being a big ego guy, sturdy, ornated, very, very massive. So we have a lot of gilt, a lot of scrolls, a lot of rich materials. The lines are very rich. Same thing in fashion. You have a lot of ribbons, a lot of lace, a lot of brocart, embroidery. So if you put the two of them together, you find a similitude in lines and in decorations. Then, of course, as always, a kind of a reaction after the death of Louis XIV. Oh, no, enough with that. We want things lighter. We want things a little more refined. We want things that have a little more subtlety. So in fashion, you get the ribbons get a little finer, a little less heavy. No lace anymore, just a white stocking and a very, very simple eau de chausse, like the pants. And, well, it follows also in the leg of the chair. The leg of the chair becomes the beautiful cabriole with this beautiful, you know, simple movement and elegant, you know. So that follows. And then after, you have Louis XVI, another reaction, enough of the curves and a little more sturdiness, but very, very simple. This is the age of neoclassical. This is the moment where they rediscovered Pompeii, for example. So you have a taste for antique. A taste for simple lines, a taste for like light floral elements. So same thing, the fashion becomes a little more simple. Everything is plain color, everything is like straight lines. And if you look at the chair, this is the moment where you get the straight fluted leg, where you get straight decorations, stripes, enough of the curves and the elegant lines. So you can really, really, really follow this way. And if you continue afterwards with Napoleon and Victorian age and whatever, you can continue the comparison.
Christophe Pourny, author of The Furniture Bible. In the Victorian age, what was the most favored piece of sterling flatware for eating ice cream? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker,
and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Victoria was my queen. Victoria, 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 Victoria. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. In the Victorian age, what was the favored piece of sterling flatware for eating ice cream? The ice cream fork. Ice cream fork? Yes, this special piece of flatware has the bowl of a small cream soup spoon tipped with fat tines like a fork. In fact, the ice cream fork could be considered the precursor to what today is known as the spork. My ice cream forks are one of my favorite pieces of my own Gorham Poppy pattern. They're in use every time we celebrate a birthday or when a dessert consists of ice cream and cake. I'm Poppy Tooker, and ice cream forks are a wonderful way to enjoy real Louisiana eats.
Yes, you scream ice cream. Everybody want ice cream, right? Right, my baby, right? Everybody want ice cream, rock, rock my belly, rock. Oh, see all
I'm Tom Savage. I'm Director of Museum Affairs at the Winterthur Museum in Wilmington, Delaware, the former Delaware estate of Henry Francis DuPont, a great horticulturist, farmer, and of course, collector of American antiques.
As curator of Henry Francis DuPont's former estate, the Winterthur Museum, Tom Savage possesses a unique passion for antiquities. While this kind of passion is quite often cultivated over many decades, a certain 14-year-old student arrived at St. Andrews for his first day of boarding school, having already acquired the collector's itch.
And the masters came around at night. There were a few quivering lips from the boys who were homesick, and there were a few antics from the boys who were tossing footballs over the cubicles. And when they got to me, I was happy as a clam, sitting upright in my bed, reading the current issue of the magazine Antiques.
Tom's early love for antiques paved the way for him to become overseer of one of the most prestigious and voluminous early American collections in the world. We spoke with Tom, who offered us a peek behind the curtains into one of the DuPont family's finest homes.
Well, our founder was, of course, a rabid collector. So when Henry Francis DuPont and his wife and two daughters lived in the main house at Winterthur, there were 53 services of china in use.
53? And how many, approximately, did each one of the services serve?
It varied. It could be a service for 6, or for 12, or 24, or many more. And Mr. DuPont had a napkin embroiderer, and he would often match the napkins, their colors, their borders, their embroidery to each of these services. When you were a house guest at Winterthur over a long weekend, you never saw the same table setting or the same flowers twice.
Oh, how spectacular. How do you curate these things now?
Well, of course, many of Mr. DuPont's table settings, sadly, were sold. We do still have a few, but Winterthur today is known for his collection. So we specialize in objects made or used in America between about 1650 and about 1840. And so there are huge collections of Delftware, of English stonewares and pearlwares and Wedgwood. Most American tablewares in the colonial period of any pretense would have come from abroad, and at that period, usually British imports. There are, of course, the simpler potteries made in Pennsylvania, made in the South, made in New England, common wares, but we have a vast collection. Winitor's collection numbers over 130,000 objects, so we have a lot to pull from our encyclopedic review of early America.
Let's pretend that we have an opportunity to visit the dining room at Winterthur with you. Tell us about the various pieces of furniture that are included, what they were used for, and what that experience is like. How large is the dining room?
Well, first, allow me to say that there are about 24 dining rooms at Winterthur. Now, many of those are historic room settings, what many people call period rooms. We've ceased to call them period rooms because they're really Mr. DuPont's rooms. Some of them were meant to be used, as is the case with the main dining room, which we call the DuPont dining room. And there, we actually do set the table as Mr. DuPont would have set it. So we use one of his services that survives, his glassware, and we remind people by having the trappings of the period when the family lived in the house to remind them that this is a collector's house. So there might be cigarettes on the table with ashtrays, something one never sees today. And we have menu cards. Actually, Mr. DuPont used porcelain menu cards for his guests with the menu written out. Now we only have one in front of his chair because his dear friend and Harvard roommate one night sneaked into the dining room and put prices besides all the menu items. He was not amused, and from henceforth, he only had one menu card in front of his place.
Oh, yeah. That's hilarious. Like there was going to be a charge after dinner, huh? What was his choice in flatware, in crystal? Which is the pattern that's laid on the table?
Well, there are many services of flatware. King's pattern, of course, being much beloved of collectors. The glassware varied a great deal. A lot of colored glass, because cobalt glass, for example, glass that would match the flower arrangements. He had such a vast, really, butler's pantry from which to create these fantasies. And so the flatware and the glassware, as well as the plates and the china, would relate to what flowers were in season at that time.
Whose crystal did they prefer?
He's using actually mostly old glass. So there is Irish glass, and of course, America in the 19th century manufactured absolutely fantastic tablewares. Ohio was a great center. Pittsburgh, of course, wonderful Pittsburgh glass. There's New England glass. So he tends to go in for the early manufacturers. He's using antique glassware for most of his dinners.
You know, there's something that's striking me as you're speaking about Mr. DuPont. Did Mrs. DuPont ever have any say at all in this? It seems like the dining room appears to have been his venue.
She had a great deal of say, and we always have to explain this to our guests because he takes pride of place. It was his ancestral home. He was born there. He died there. But she was immensely proud of him and a wonderful hostess. But she did once write to her mother that she felt rather like a dachshund being chased by a greyhound. He was always up to something. But for him, the dining room was the culmination of a weekend's house party. It was theater, and when the doors were open, the show was ready to begin. There were footmen, liveried footmen, for every two guests waiting table.
Oh my goodness, it was a little bit upstairs downstairs, wasn't it?
Upstairs downstairs.
How many servants were there in the house?
The indoor staff would have appeared larger than it actually was, about 12 men, and they changed costume as many times as the guests did. So there was morning livery, afternoon livery, and evening livery. So it appeared that there were dozens and dozens, when actually there were fewer. The female staff, the cooks, the maids, were never seen, and in fact were not uniformed because they were invisible.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. We've done a lot of research on American forms of servitude. And of course, we had a wonderful Downton Abbey exhibition where we compared the British country house with a house like Winitore. And Americans forget that we had many, many houses on a scale of Downton Abbey, and in fact, much grander.
What were their living quarters like? Tell us more about this, what it would have been like to be in servitude. I have to admit, I'm sitting here a bit shocked that the women were invisible.
They were invisible. The guests never saw them. Of course, the family would have. They lived, in many cases, in segregated areas of the estate. Most of the indoor staff were actually Scandinavian or French. So there was a real pecking order in American households, and it was the very chic thing to do to have Northern European Protestant indoor servants, cooks, butlers, the footmen.
What's the kitchen like?
Sadly, the kitchen no longer exists, and this is one of our biggest visitor disappointments, because the minute the family moved out of the house in 1951, their bathrooms, their dressing rooms, their kitchens, their butler's pantries were ripped out. Many of the fittings actually went into their new house. This was really after the war, so there was some frugality even among the DuPonts. But for our recent spring tour, we just did what we call essence of bathroom, and we recreated one of the bathrooms at Winitore, and I'm sure we'll be doing this with a butler's pantry soon.
What was the bathroom like?
Well, most of the rooms had a communicating bathroom, because if you were married guests, you would have your own room as the wife, and your husband would have his own room. And often there was a communicating dressing room and bathroom between your individual rooms. That was also the case with Mr. and Mrs. DuPont. They had separate suites of rooms.
Tom, I have to say thank you for the private tour we just had of Winitore. I'm so tickled our Louisiana Eats listeners got to visit you there, in essence.
Thank you. Well, I will look forward to welcoming all of your listeners to Winitore. That would be a great privilege.
Tom Savage, Director of Museum Affairs at the Winitore Museum.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week as we visit a California farm that concentrates entirely on cultivating specialty mushrooms.
In cuisine, we steal words from the French that we can't say in English. Sauté, roux, in the mushroom industry, we steal words from the Japanese, because there's no word for kinkake in English.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and with support from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Join us on Thursday, September the 29th at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum when Louisiana Eats and French Market Coffee help celebrate Toujac's Restaurant's historic 160th anniversary with the first in a series of wine-paired dinners to benefit the museum. To learn more, call Toujac's at 504
525-8676 or visit them online at toujexrestaurant.com. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.